When you wake up in the morning, are you raring to go? Or do you think to yourself, what could possibly be the point? Doing what works will help you see it isn't too late to go after your dreams. We talk with experts about everything from getting in shape to finding work you love. We're your guide to a better life. Now, here's your host for Doing What Works, Maureen Anderson.
The comedian Jerry Seinfeld tells a story in the documentary Comedian about members of the Glenn Miller Orchestra who trudged through the snow to a farmhouse after their plane landed a long way from anywhere. They were all dressed in suits, they were all carrying instruments, and they arrived at the house one big, wet, sloppy mess. They looked through the window at a perfect, beautiful family enjoying a perfect, beautiful meal. One band member turned to the other as they took in this Norman Rockwell scene and asked, how do people live like that? Well, we have a special treat for you on the program today in my continuing quest to show you just how many ways there are to make a living. We're going to introduce you to a man who makes his living helping orchestras stay in business. Daryl Anderson, my husband and producer, is at the controls as always, but he's feeling a little bit under the weather, so I won't be asking him to contribute very much, if at all. But we both want to welcome Drew McManus, who will help parents, for example, decide how to feel if their little prodigy has decided to make music his or her career. Welcome to the show, Drew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. How did you become such an expert at keeping orchestras in business?
Out of necessity of keeping myself in business, first of all. I started off life trying to be a professional musician. I went to conservatory, a traditional conservatory, and fortunately for myself, found out that I wasn't quite good enough to be a professional early on, so I was able to at least make a career shift toward the administrative side of making music.
I want to dive into that a little bit because it's so important. First of all, what instrument did you play?
I was a tuba major.
Tuba? Oh my gosh.
That makes everybody smile.
It does, because the act of just getting that instrument from here to there is such a challenge.
It is, actually, and there's something in the business called cartage that musicians who play large or unwieldy instruments get as an additional payment more often than not. So, yes, actually, that does come into play quite often.
Huh. So interesting. Is conservatory considered college? Is it a college?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's a traditional four-year degree. There are traditional conservatories, something like Juilliard or Curtis, that will be their own self-sustaining institutions. And then there are those that are attached to other universities. For example, Peabody Conservatory is part of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Cincinnati Conservatory of Music is part of University of Cincinnati. But they are all accredited degree programs.
Where did you go?
I went to Peabody, and I also attended Towson University, which is in Baltimore as well.
How long into your college career was it before you decided you probably weren't going to be able to perform in professional orchestras?
Toward the end, probably a little bit after I had graduated, I had a small break between the first few years and last few years to earn some money to finish college. And that was a good period of time to get a bit of more real-life experience, although I had to put myself through college. So there was a good bit of that going on to begin with. Plus, that's also what led me into moving into administrative and governance. I've worked my way through school mostly by working in administrative positions, either starting off as an intern or whatever entry-level position that I could get, and then had a large degree of experience in the different fields of specialty, marketing, development, operations, so on and so forth.
Was the conservatory curriculum skewed at all towards administrative work for people who were hedging their bets, for example?
No, not at all. Arts administration degrees are actually separate degree programs, and they've existed for 20-plus years. So they've certainly been around, and it's not unusual for musicians to maybe switch from a performance or education degree toward an arts administration degree, although honestly it's more common that an AA degree, as they're called, are usually something more along the lines of an MBA or a postgraduate degree program.
Does it ever work in reverse?
Well, you know, I do know a few folks who have done that, but it is very much the exception to the rule.
Because if you are truly gifted, it probably showed up in kindergarten or earlier.
It usually does, yes. And that's actually an interesting aspect of itself when you mentioned parents earlier, is seeing children who are pushed at earlier and earlier ages once that talent is recognized to be competitive, because it is an excessively competitive field to get a job as a full-time orchestra musician. It's in many ways statistically easier to be a professional athlete. So that competition isn't just tough, it starts at a very early age.
That's staggering, because the odds against becoming a professional athlete are very much stacked against anyone. I wonder if a parent who sees a child with a gift in music is, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, but is being irresponsible by steering that child toward competition and so on, unless the child is just hell-bent on it and can imagine no other life for himself or herself, even at age 3 or 4, unbelievable as that sounds, but I bet it happens, because you are signing up for such a different life. You are going to give up so much, and you better have some sense early on it's going to be worth it.
Well, I think it depends. One thing I try to avoid are universal applications. Because every situation is different, especially with talent, as it can also be developed at different points in a child's life. It's interesting, my wife, who is also a professional musician, her name is Holly Mulcahy. She's the concertmaster of the Chattanooga Symphony and Opera. And we met at conservatory. We've had this discussion with ourselves and with students of ours who had an interest in being a professional musician, in that a lot of the most talented people we knew tended to burn out very early, because it's not just being talented, because the competition is so tight, it's being able to maintain a grind of one to several to perhaps a decade's worth of time before you finally land a job. And all the talent in the world can't prepare you for maintaining yourself during that period of time.
Do you have kids?
No, you don't.
Okay. So I can dispense with that. Are they following in their parents' footsteps? No.
No, and neither one of us actually come from musical families either. So we both entered into it with very much eyes closed. If anything, the advice that we give parents is designed toward trying to allow them to enter into the process with their eyes wide open. It's fair to understand what the competitive nature is. It's fair to understand what the success and failure rates are. It's fair to understand what the costs involved are as well. But that shouldn't necessarily dissuade you from wanting to try. And if you decide to do it, give it your all. And if you fail, you fail. If you succeed, you succeed. No different than everything else in life.
It sounds expensive.
It's very expensive, yes. I mean, conservatory education is usually expensive, because if they're attached to a university, they're usually very expensive universities, like Johns Hopkins University. There are a few exceptions, like Curtis, which is a tuition-free school, but that's also very competitive to get into. And then there's the cost of the instruments themselves. If you're a string musician, for example, the cost of a good professional-level instrument can be staggering to most people. Entry-level would be around $10,000 to $15,000 for an instrument.
Oh, my gosh. And the cost to families outside of, you know, cash outlay, tremendous.
Right. If a student is fortunate enough to come from a family that is either just supportive of regardless of whatever their career decision is, or if they come from a family with one or more member who is a professional musician and has that insider's point of view, I think they're in a good position to get some unique support, but there's always going to be more of the stereotypical approach of, if it were a country and western tune, it would be Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Or, with my parents for the longest time, wondered when I would be interested in getting, quote, a real job.
Yes, I admit, I was surprised to learn that orchestras had consultants. I just hadn't thought about life to that extent. Is the world of orchestra consulting competitive?
Far more now than it was when I started. I've got just over 20 years in the field, and when I started, I could count on one hand the number of consultants that specialized in orchestras. But now there are dozens and dozens and dozens. It's almost what I like to call the cultural industrial process, where people who were managers leave to become consultants and then they cycle back into the business and in and out. Part of it is because the field itself has grown over the years. It's a much larger field than people realize, both as an economic engine to their local communities and as an artistic contributor to their community.
The voice you are listening to is that of Drew McManus. He is my guest on Doing What Works today. He writes a blog about the orchestra business, provides a platform for arts insiders to speak their minds, keeps track of what people in that business get paid, and helps write a satirical cartoon about orchestra life. We'll be delving into a typical day in the life of Drew McManus in just a few minutes on Doing What Works.
We wish solving your toughest problems was easy, but if so, you wouldn't need us. Doing What Works is the help desk with a positive attitude.
Back with Doing What Works and a conversation with a consultant to orchestras. His name is Drew McManus. He's from Chicago. His website, or one of them anyway, is orchestraconsulting.com. Drew, how many years have you been helping orchestras of all budget sizes, I should say, stay in business?
Just over 20.
Just over 20. And how do you do it? Is there a way to break it down for us?
Well, it's really being an entrepreneur, first and foremost, because there's two basic directions you can go as a consultant, which is becoming part of a firm and working with other professionals to offer some sort of usually specialized package of services. Or you can go the direction that I've moved, which is more the lone wolf approach, where I'm a one-man shop and I work with organizations directly as a self-employed entrepreneur.
The question I was getting at was more along the lines of the quote that you so often feature on your online presence, which is that when someone sees you, they assume they're about to get fired.
Oh. Yeah, that is part of the work that I do, is sometimes executive oversight and review. I do a great deal of due diligence, and for a long stretch of time, that did happen when I would go to work with an organization. Is boards of directors, it's not unusual for them to have a little bit of difficulty really fulfilling their duty as the stewards of public trust, because the business of nonprofit performing arts is unique enough and different enough from traditional commercial enterprises, which is where most board members come from, that they need that additional bit of assistance. And consultants can be useful in that process and being able to help them give as thorough of an overview and oversight process that they need to put into place. And yes, sometimes that does result in individuals embracing career change.
That's a good way to put it. When you keep track of the salaries and compensation for everyone from musicians to the executives involved with an orchestra, what do you think we would be the most surprised by?
Well, probably not just the top-end figure. highest budget organizations, which nonprofit performing arts organizations like orchestra, are usually ranked by how much money they need to spend per year, their budget size. That can be upwards of a few million dollars for something like the music director, and in some cases the CEOs can earn over $1 million. Whereas on the other end of that scale, a CEO may earn maybe only $50,000 to $60,000 a year.
And compare that with the compensation for musicians, can you?
Right. There's even more variation there, because for a music director or a CEO or an executive director, it's basically more of a salaried, traditional, full-time, 9-to-5 job. But for musicians, there's even more variety. The larger budget organizations will employ their musicians as full-time salaried employees. So they have a weekly rate they make that's fixed. But on the other end of that scale, there are what are known as per-service organizations, which I hesitate to use the word part-time because it's not quite accurate. Instead, the musicians still have the same expectations as far as the degree of artistic caliber, the degree of preparation and personal practice they have to put into the job. But instead of being paid a salary, they're paid for every service, which includes either a rehearsal or a performance, typically. And they're given either a minimum number of service guarantees per year, which you can see the difference then stacked up to a salary, which is 50 or 52 weeks a year, regardless of what they do during that week, the musicians get paid. In the other organizations, they're paid that minimum per service rate, which usually only runs anywhere between maybe 15 and 30 weeks per year.
Drew McManus, the man you are listening to on Doing What Works Today, a consultant to orchestras, is talking about something that I want to dive into a little bit more after the commercial, which is orchestra life more appealing to a musician who doesn't want to play in a band, for example, and have all the uncertainties that anybody who's ever followed a band knows about when it comes to their finances? In other words, is orchestra life more like having a day job? That's one thing we'll talk about next on Doing What Works.
A big hello and thanks to all in the Robinson, Illinois area who are listening to Doing What Works today on WTAY AM.
Is being in an orchestra the musical equivalent of having a day job, as opposed to, say, starting a band in that proverbial garage? For the answer, we turn to my guest on Doing What Works Today. His name is Drew McManus. He is a consultant to orchestras. He's very good at his work, and you can learn all about that at orchestraconsulting.com. Will you speak to that issue, Drew?
Sure. It takes far more hours than most people realize, meaning it's definitely not going to be a 9-to-5 kind of job. Depending on the type of orchestra that musicians perform with, their rehearsal schedule, their service schedule, could be during the days, it could be during the evenings, and it could be split up between the two. Performances are typically on the evenings. Not unusual to have them on Friday evening or the weekends, so that time is usually eaten up for musicians. Holiday periods can also be eaten up quite quickly. During the winter holiday, you'll have Nutcracker performances, Messiahs, those sort of winter shows, and those can happen on more frequent basis. So, yes, if you're looking for a 9-to-5 job, the last thing you probably want to do is be an orchestra musician.
You would have to love it to turn your entire life over to it.
Hopefully, and hopefully you won't lose that love of it either. It can become quite a grind.
What percentage of people have you found who just, like you said earlier, burn out on the life?
Well, that's something that's never been officially studied, which is a real shame because the field actually has a comparatively low job satisfaction rate. There was a study done, it's quite some time ago now. I believe it was the late 90s, early 2000s, where job satisfaction of professional orchestra musicians was roughly on par to that of prison guards.
Oh.
That gives you kind of an idea of what the grind can end up like. Here you are, someone who goes through a conservatory or a college to be creative, to be artistic, and the role of an orchestra musician in the long term is to be a very specialized part of one well-oiled machine. So being able to flex those creative muscles is not something the individual musicians always have the opportunity to do. And that can be something that they may not have necessarily mentally prepared themselves for from a 20 to 30 year career span.
I may embarrass myself with this question, but will computers ever replace orchestras?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Computerized music is in and of itself something that's always going to exist, but it is decidedly a separate niche. The only time I've actually seen a computerized or digitized version of live musicians is sometimes within the gaming industry, the computer gaming industry. And in those cases, it's not necessarily a digitally reproduced approximation of an instrument. They'll actually take the live instrument and do what's called sampling, take bits and pieces of them playing a number of different ways, and they string that together. Most people can still, even regardless your level of understanding or listening experience, can sit down and hear two pieces side by side, and more often than not, easily still tell the difference, even with the best digital versions of orchestras. But there's something that you obviously can't replace in the human element that makes a live artistic experience what it is, and I would be surprised if it's ever replaced by computers.
Back to the job satisfaction aspect of this work, you are blowing my mind in that I always looked at orchestra musicians as having this dream job. They could play music to their heart's content and be part of something bigger that, I mean, all you have to do is listen to 10 seconds to be moved by the music. And yet, I'm starting to think, as I'm talking with you, that each individual musician feels more like a cog in a machine.
Right. The cog in the wheels syndrome is actually quite prevalent in the field. Now, what I think speaks to the quality of a musician's training and their dedication is, even though that cog in the wheel syndrome may be in full force with someone in their career, as the listener, that doesn't come across. When it comes time for them to sit on stage and they play the music, it doesn't matter if they've played that piece 112 times. If it's especially your first time hearing it, they still need to make it as special, sparkling, and bright so that it reaches you in a meaningful way. And then when they are done, they go home, then they can feel the way they want to feel about their career. The best of musicians are the ones that are still able to do that regardless of what their own personal satisfaction level is.
Well, is it the response from the audience that makes it a life they love?
That adds quite a bit, yes. There's absolutely no doubt that the energy that's shared from the stage to the audience is palpable. And that helps musicians and the listener as well get into the moment, so to speak, where you forget everything else in your day. You're just focusing on what you're listening to. It's creating whatever is happening in your mind while you're listening. And that energy absolutely is reflected back onto the stage and can help musicians reach that high that you talk to them enough, you'll start to hear this more and more as a recurring theme, where that same musical high that they experience on stage for most of them is one of the reasons why they're musicians to begin with, too. So, yes, it's very important.
Drew, you're making me think it's not just wishful thinking, this perception I have of why YouTube is not going to kill the public speaking profession, in that I have watched a speaker on YouTube, and I've also watched a speaker in person in the same room, and it's different. There's an energy transfer when you're in the same room with someone, and I think that's what you're alluding to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, technology itself cycles on a regular basis, where first the phonograph was going to kill live music and live experiences, and then movies, and then radio, and then cassettes, and then so on and so on and so on and so on. YouTube is just the latest iteration of this. I think when used well, any good piece of technology only enhances the experience and can go a long way toward increasing interest in the live experience. But yes, nothing's ever going to replace the live experience.
Well, you wouldn't want to talk with an orchestra consultant without asking that gentleman how, for example, you do get a tuba on an airplane. And that's just part of the fun you'll have if you stay tuned for Doing What Works. If I paid thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars for a musical instrument, I would not want to let baggage handlers, for example, with any airline, get their mitts anywhere near it, which would leave me with a problem. How do I get it on the plane? That's one thing I want to cover next with the orchestra consultant we're talking with on Doing What Works today. His name is Drew McManus. Drew, I bet you have some stories.
Oh, do I? Yeah. First hand and second. It's exactly as difficult as you said. And for professional musicians, string players in particular, $10,000 to $20,000 is actually an inexpensive instrument. There was one client of mine I had where he's a very famous cellist. He has a cello that's worth about $3 million. And I actually had to more or less Sherpa the instrument from the United States over to Germany. And the cello gets its own seat, it gets its own ticket, but from the moment you walk in, there's always going to be a problem getting it through the security, getting the gate agent to understand that you have a ticket and you can bring it on. Then you have to deal with the flight crew. The pilot, for whatever reason, may not want an instrument strapped into a seat, and then you have to deal with that.
But why wouldn't he want that?
Oh, I would love to know the reason myself. There never really seems to be a solid reason. I mean, one that does pop up from time to time is, well, they're concerned about it coming loose. Well, it's strapped in with several different buckles, and it's usually the most secure item inside the cabin at any given time. And if you're something like a violinist or a violist, then your instrument will hopefully fit in the overhead, so there's no concern there. But the instruments are unusual dimensions, the cases are. And so you'll get hassled for that if you're a musician. It's become obviously worse since 9/11, and security concerns have kicked in. But there's also been the trend of airlines scaling down the size of seats, scaling down the amount of space in overhead bins. And it's gotten bad enough that the American Federation of Musicians, which is the union that represents most professional musicians, has pushed very hard for the federal government to include exceptions in the federal aviation guidelines that require airlines to allow musicians to bring their instruments on board with them, and especially if they've had a ticket paid for it.
Huh. It doesn't sound like this one is going to get completely solved in our lifetime. It also makes me wonder if there are other aspects to orchestra life that we might be interested in that we don't even know to ask about.
Well, one of them is going to be that differentiation between the salaried musician and the per service musician. A per service musician may make anywhere between $5,000 and $30,000 a year with one ensemble, which is not enough to really raise a family on, more or less even have an individual income on. That means you're going to have to either hold positions in multiple ensembles, which in places where there are orchestras that are close enough together within driving distance, they're what are colloquially known as freeway philharmonics, where a musician will play in two or three ensembles in order to earn a living, but that also means you spend a lot of time on the road, driving from point A to point B, on top of the amount of time that you spend practicing, and you get less and less and less time to actually have a life.
Yes, and it also seems like the dates of the performances would clash so often that it almost wouldn't be worth it, or would it?
Well, that's fascinating, too, because in some areas, the individual ensembles will actually coordinate their schedules. The administrators will work together to make sure those conflicts don't happen, because there's a limited pool of musicians that are quality enough that they want to use. So there's no use fighting over people and making the musicians go through some kind of Sophie's Choice scenario. But there are situations where there are ensembles that will intentionally schedule their services on the same time as another because they want the musicians to choose that group. It's not necessarily in the musician's best interest, and it may not even ultimately be in the ensemble's best interest, but that's what they want to do nonetheless.
Singers cannot perform too often, or they will not have any vocal cords left. Is the same true of musicians?
Yes. There are all sorts of physical stress-related injuries that are common with each different instrument. They all have their own unique aspects. The brass players, wind players have problems with what's called focal dystonia, which is a loss of control of the muscles in the facial and the embouchure area. Tendinitis is extremely common for string players and other types of repetitive stress types of injuries. In salaried orchestras, it's quite common actually to work in what are called relief weeks, where a musician will be rotated off a particular week in order to reduce the impact or potential for developing a repetitive stress-related injury.
You know, you go to a holiday concert, you see the musicians up on stage, you think, boy, that'd be a nice gig. You just show up, you whip out your violin or whatever, you play, you have fun, you're all dressed up, you go home. Man, it's like anything else in life. There's so much to it. I am so happy we are getting a glimpse into orchestra life with the consultant, Drew McManus, and we have a few more minutes left with him on Doing What Works. Every month, more than 10,000 board members, managers, artists, and patrons visit Adaptastration to learn more about arts management and the orchestra business. Since its inaugural post about 11 years ago, Adaptastration quickly established itself as the must-read online orchestra business column. And you can learn all about that at orchestraconsulting.com. I think Drew McManus, my guest, the orchestra consultant, is that where you get to it, or does Adaptastration have its own URL?
That's exactly it, adaptastration.com.
Is it? Okay, well, that makes sense. That makes sense. But orchestraconsulting.com is your consulting business.
Correct, right. And I have a segment of that business actually called VentureIndustriesOnline.com, which focuses on a particular technology service that I offer performing arts organizations.
I don't know which of these you want to cover in the last few minutes of the show. I'm guessing the more positive, but I was curious what orchestras in the country are thriving and why, and or what orchestras are falling apart and why.
The economic downturn did a lot of good for the field in that it tore away a patina of success that too many groups were putting forward when the reality is underneath that there was far more turmoil financially and from a labor perspective than what was known. those groups, unsurprisingly perhaps, are the ones having trouble. But there are plenty of other groups that are not just surviving the economic downturn, they're thriving and growing. The Seattle Symphony is a great example. Here in Chicago, Chicago Symphony is doing wonderful. The Los Angeles Philharmonic is in good shape. Nashville Symphony had a very close brush with death, but really pulled themselves together and used the knowledge and experience and some good labor relations they had been building on over the years to get through that very difficult time. So there are plenty of success stories, not unlike most other businesses. And by and large, the musicians themselves still enjoy an extremely satisfying, unique, and special career. It's not all just grind.
It's not all what we've been talking about for the whole hour, is what you're
right.
saying.
Everything else is the eyes wide open part of it, but that magical, special part of what I think you had projected earlier is also very much part of what makes that job and that career choice a truly wonderful and unique choice.
What orchestra nudges Academy Award winners off the stage during that telecast?
Oh, those are studio players. In Los Angeles, it's a unique environment because in addition to something like the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which is a traditional, very large budget orchestra, there's an entire segment separate of that of classically trained orchestra musicians that do that type of work. They record film scores, television work, game show work, and they also do those live Academy shows as well.
Do they ever freelance for musicians like, for example, Billy Joel?
Yes, absolutely. They'll do that sort of work in town. Sometimes they will be part of a traveling show, but honestly, they like staying home more often than not, close to family and being able to have some more of a regular presence. But they'll also do substitute or sometimes play in what we were talking about with Freeway Philharmonics in the Los Angeles area as well.
Is that ever a stepping stone to a full-time gig with one outfit?
I wouldn't say so, no. There are musicians that do the studio work actually do quite well. It's from a dollar-to-dollar perspective, it's every bit as competitive as a traditional orchestra job. But the playing cycle, the rehearsal cycle, and obviously the type of music you're playing is going to be different than a traditional orchestra.
10 or 15 seconds, what would you most like people to remember from this hour?
Oh, that the orchestra field is something that is unique, it's special. It also is something that helps define who and what community is. Being part of your orchestra just by attending or paying attention to what goes on gives you a different insight into who you are as people and what your community is.
One word, bravo.
Thank you.
Drew McManus, OrchestraConsulting.com. Thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for listening to Doing What Works.
This broadcast is copyrighted by North Shore Productions. To learn more about the show, you're invited to visit MaureenAnderson.com. You can read Maureen's blog, listen to her podcast, or pass along suggestions for the program. I'm Cindy Weir. Thanks for listening, and tune in again next week for more great advice and inspiration on Doing What Works.